Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Fiction File Podcast, where we explore the wide world of narrative entertainment, from movies to literature and everything in between. My name is Jason Boyd. I'm the editor of Fiction File, and I'm joined remotely today by managing editor Corinne Asbell. Hey, Corinne.
Hey, guys.
Also, somewhere in an undisclosed location in cyberspace, we have associate editor Dalton McKay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. Doing great.
Yeah, stay low, stay frosty.
I'm in my bunker.
Very good. That's where you belong, especially nowadays with the climate as it is. Yes. So today we'll be send help if you can. Send Charmin. So today we'll be poring over a single work of fiction. After we introduce this work of art, we'll discuss what makes it enjoyable, what makes it a work of art in the first place, what makes it universally relatable, and finally, we'll talk about what it could have done better. So now we have our format. What piece of narrative entertainment are we talking about today, Corinne?
So we've got Ghostbusters on the agenda today. The original one that was released June 8th, 1984, and was produced and directed by Ivan Reitman and released by Columbia Pictures. It's written by stars Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, who, along with Bill Murray and Ernie Hudson, played the titular Ghostbusters.
After the members of a team of scientists lose their cushy positions at a university in New York City, they decide to become Ghostbusters to wage a high-tech battle with the supernatural for money. They stumble upon a gateway to another dimension, a doorway that will release evil upon the city. The Ghostbusters must now save New York from complete destruction.
Excellent. And thank you for saying titular, Corinne. It's gave me a little giggle.
So let's
go. Titles, Mr. Connery. That's famous titles.
But titular for 100. And so critical opinion summary. Let's just go kind of like over what the critics thought of this real quick so we have some perspective. IMDb, and of course these scores may change when you check it now, but IMDb has it at 7.8 out of 10. Metacritic is 71 out of 100. And Rotten Tomatoes, interesting here, critics have it at 97%. Audience has it at 88%. So audience, not as big of fans. Interesting. But let's kind of move on to our first topic here. Yeah, I'm kind of the opposite on it, honestly. But let's move on to our topics here and start with Corinne. If you do like it, depending on if you're in that 12% that don't like Ghostbusters, what makes Ghostbusters enjoyable, Corinne?
Well, for me, it's got to be the script. The movie is infinitely quotable. I mean, obviously not counting the theme song, because, you know, that wasn't written by him. But to be fair, when I say, who are you going to call? You know, you all just said Ghostbusters.
Right.
Now, Bill Murray plays Dr. Peter Venkman with a sort of cool detachment and irreverent attitude while delivering some of the best quips. It's peak Bill Murray, and considering his SNL history with Dan Aykroyd, it's as if the role was written for him. I think it was, but I'm not 100% sure on that fact. And then you take that witty script and you couple that with the fact that despite its paranormal otherworldliness, Ghostbusters is a very simple story at its core. Three parapsychologists, say that five times fast, get laid off and become entrepreneurs to make money and save the world in the process. I mean, that's the simplest thing ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super simple story structure. Say that five times fast.
Yeah, so Dalton, what do you think makes Ghostbusters enjoyable?
For me, it's the humor. It's my favorite kind of humor. It's very dry and sarcastic. And it's part of the reason why I think it's vastly superior to the 2016 film, which is, again, part of that sort of Funko Pop plastic meta and lowbrow, and it's far too lowbrow to be funny. This really set the bar for comedy in general, not just for Ghostbusters films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much my take. And by the way, I like how we're having a very sober, subdued conversation about the first comedy that we've covered. The first out-and-out comedy.
Exactly.
That we're just very, well, yes, I found it humorous. Although that is kind of, you know. It,
right. Can we finally but do the, what you want us to, and you're getting, and you're calling us out on it?
Straighten up, yous. But yeah. No. But all jokes aside, what I think makes Ghostbusters enjoyable is, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it's the dumbest concept in the world. I mean, it's
oh yeah.
I mean, first you have the whole like Ghostbusters. I mean, that's just a joke itself. It's already like starts as a pun, you know, or a joke in itself, and then you have just like the fact that they're wearing these overalls and everything like that. It's so dumb, but yet we still find ourselves wanting to root for these folks. Like, they're just relatable. You know, a lot of that has to do with just honestly the acting, the writing, and the directing. I mean, it just comes down to like the synthesis of those three things really create this sense of relatability almost, which we'll get to later. But that's one of the things that makes it most enjoyable to me, is that you feel like, even though these people are supposed to be like, some of them are, you know, college professors, they seem like regular Joes who are just like trying to like make a living.
Oh yeah.
So there's something endearing about that. So it's like you have this dumb concept, but yet you like the people involved. So you're like, all right, you know, I'll go along for the ride. It's character focused.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of comedies get lost in the high concept. They get lost in, you know, just making jokes or wacky or outrageous scenes. But they forget about, you know, just characters that you actually want to root for.
Yeah, so to me, that's the humor. Yeah. The humor is very subtle. Like, one of the best sight gags in the entire movie is it's very subtle. They're in an elevator and they haven't like, Egon says, you know, you're wearing a tiny fusion reactor on your back. I regret that I haven't tested it yet. And then there's like, you know, a couple minutes, and then he just sort of turns it on. And then he sort of inches away from it as if it's going to help, like right. into the corner, like almost pushing Bill Murray over, who's looking quite annoyed.
Right. Yeah. It's, and a lot of the, I'll touch on this later, but a lot of the comedy has, it comes from the characters themselves being kind of funny people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, they're making jokes in world, which is, again, something that a lot of comedies today could learn from, is that, like, it's okay for the characters to be charismatic and funny themselves. And, you know, it's not just about a joke for the audience. It's a joke for the world as well. But exactly. I think we've all agreed and come to the critical consensus that Ghostbusters is indeed a successful comedy.
Yes. Yes.
A little bit.
Sage nod.
Moving on to the more important question, I guess, is what makes Ghostbusters a work of art? So I'll kick it off. Is basically, I think it is, just for one thing, it's a time capsule and it encapsulates the 80s aesthetic. You know, it's postmodernism at its finest, really. And it's absurd, it's self-mocking, it's irreverent, it uses genre as a pastiche. It does all of that, yet it captures this kind of like undeniable sense of authenticity, of earnestness, which is postmodernism is not known for its earnestness. But it's postmodern without being jaded, I would say. It's because it has that relatability that comes from the acting and the directing and the writing, but yet the setup and the approach is very self-mocking, self-removed, You're kind of, you know, the characters are not always as afraid as they should be, perhaps, you know, and things like that. So there's a sense of postmodernism even with that. But you feel, you just have this intangible feeling, which I think is partly what has made some remakes unsuccessful, is that there's just something about like lightning in a bottle with that cast and that director, Ivan Reitman, legend, and the writing just all working seamlessly together. And it's just like, you can tell they're just made for this kind of a movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And it's just so authentic. It's like, it's perfectly tailored. It's like a tailored suit. But yeah, Kareen, what do you think makes Ghostbusters a work of art?
I just got to touch on what you're talking about as far as the cast, the way they were all able to come together.
Yeah.
It's just, Ghostbusters is one of the greatest ensemble casts. I don't want to say like of all time, but like top five, like one of the greatest ensembles. I mean, you know, going into it with Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, it's going to be funny as hell. But the way the entire cast just seems to connect, it just brings that movie together and really makes the movie enjoyable and great. You got the comedic timing of Murray and Aykroyd and Harold Ramis with Ernie Hudson as the straight man. It's gold. And then, you know, usually when you've got the heavyweights, there's usually one that stands, especially the comedic heavyweights, usually one stands out more than the other. Like, this is the comedy star.
Right.
But no one's stealing the limelight. It's a shared thing. They're all, like, playing off of each other. Right. And the way they're just, they share the spotlight. And then I think it helps that the movie is just kind of timeless. I mean, obviously there's some dated aspects, you know, the 80s aesthetic, the wardrobe, the hair, the lack of regard for secondhand smoke, but the comedy is pretty timeless as well. I mean, it's not reliant on time-sensitive gags or a lot of pop culture references like that would make it dated. And I think that just really helps keep it, you know, timeless and great.
That's true. Very good. Yeah, very true. It's very timeless, even though it is such a time capsule at the same time. And a lot of that's because it's speaking to things of that, you know, are kind of always going to be true, just of like, you know, urban life, living in a city, you know, just the wackiness of the live and dead characters in that city, you know, and just the kind of class poverty type mindset of a lot of the characters that are in the movie, you know, even today we can relate to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I was going to say it really does speak to the movie's relatability, that you could watch it at any time and it would still apply to you and climate and whatnot.
Yeah. So Dalton, what would you say is what makes it a work of art?
Well, I just love the way that this movie twists a capitalist's wet dream into something so fun and ridiculous. It's honestly impressive. I mean, at its core, Ghostbusters is about like these four guys attempting a get rich quick scheme, and it ends up actually paying off. And then in the end, they get to be heroes. It's truly the American dream. At its finest. I would say it's actually, in that regard, it's like a modern fairy tale hidden within an 80s urban nightmare. It's like, you got all these supernatural things flying around. You've got these everymen looking out for each other. The unwitting heroes lose their jobs and take a chance on a long shot against dark forces in order to get their lives back together. I mean, that's a fairy tale plot, you know? So it's weird how they managed to make an urban fairy tale.
Right. Yeah. Very well put. Yeah. It is. It's got all those classic elements. And I mean, it is, it's funny that you mentioned fairy tale, because it's kind of it's a sci-fi movie, so to speak, because they have inventions. But, and you know, it's arguable whether fantasy is a subgenre of science fiction or whether it's its own genre with its own subgenres. But you know, regardless, it's partly fantasy because of the supernatural element. So it lends itself well to that kind of a feeling too. Like that helps,
right?
Because they feel like they're crusaders almost. You know, they're Don Quixotes transformed into an actual crusader. You know, because they actually end up doing well.
Exactly. They all win in the end. They're the underdogs, and they win in the end. And that's a classic. A classic trope of those kind of hero driven tales. And I will say that my favorite science fiction is the science fiction that is almost fantasy. And I will say that I do enjoy fantasy that almost is almost a work of science fiction. My favorite magic systems are the ones that are rooted in reality, rooted in science. The magic system in my novel world is a good example of that. And like Star Wars, that we've talked about at length, that is science fiction that is rooted in fantasy. So, you know, it's two of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's they both have something to learn from the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Dalton, why don't you keep it on this one, but let's talk about what makes Ghostbusters universally relatable.
Well, continuing on with our three heroes, this is a movie about being in over your head, like way over your head. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, these characters are these average schlubby guys at the end of their ropes. They go out on a limb for a crazy idea, and it ends up becoming far more than they realized. The movie is a series of steps, almost like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with like anime tropes. But it's almost like a shonen anime, and shonen basically like it can go on forever because there's always someone stronger. And once you defeat the bad guy, there's another bad guy that's stronger than the last bad guy. And it just keeps going ad nauseum. And the hero always becomes more powerful to meet the new challenge. And it goes on and on and on. That's how Bleach has like, I don't know, 15 seasons. Dragon Ball is still going. That's how, you know, but like it has that feel to it. We start with like a spooky invisible force in a library at the beginning. And then like we eventually see that force. And by the time we're at the end of the movie, it's a dark god descending from another dimension. It's the reality of things going out of control that makes it so relatable.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely. And it's, I love the dark god. It is kind of like they start out just thinking, hey, you know, we'll just catch some ghosts. We'll make a buck, you know, it'll be fine. And hey, we'll also prove some of our theories here.
They start out as like bug exterminators. They're like, oh, you know, these ghosts, they bump in the night. You know, they're basically cockroaches. And
right. You know, you hit that. Yes, absolutely. And that's something that we haven't mentioned is that is most definitely the analog of what that had to be an inspirational piece. It's basically bug exterminators, but for ghosts.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, even their name, Ghostbusters, is like you know, Ant Busters or whatever. You know, it would still apply.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it just has that feel, and the ad that they run, you know, where it's just very, like, hey, you want this? You want that? You know, we'll do this. It's used car salesman.
Yeah, it's an infomercial you'd see on like late night TV.
Right. Yeah, it's great. So what I think makes it universally relatable is, you know, first of all, I think its whole appeal is its relatability. Mm-hmm. They're working class guys. Ernie Hudson himself, you know, is just needs a job. The other three, which I think is just, it's so funny, but also like, so like, yeah, no, I get it. You know, sometimes you just need a friggin' job. You just need to pick up some cash. And the other guys are like scientists and PhDs, but yet I never feel like they're aristocratic or elitist. Mm-hmm. I think part of that is kind of because it's so rooted in New York, and the three white characters come from SNL, or at least the one that wasn't on SNL might Harold not Ramis. Harold Ramis, sorry. Harold Ramis. He has that same mystique of being with Bill Murray and, you know, Stripes and things like that. Mm-hmm. So he's in that world, but they kind of just have an authentic New York feel. So it's like it's based in New York, and you're like, these guys are New Yorkers, or at this point they are, because they've been on SNL and they're in that world of New York. Mm-hmm. They're representative of New York. And again, that's part of the lightning in the bottle aspect of it, is that like you have a blend of the real world and the fantasy world of the movie. And yeah, you can have relatability with the actors, and they have a persona off screen mm-hmm. that you can hook into in the movie. And it's, you know, you just don't get that with everyone. And it's something that they seem to not necessarily try very hard to
hide.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say in remakes to recreate.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, they do use some SNL people, you know, but
SNL, not quite. SNL's a different beast today.
Right.
Yeah. Than it was back then.
You should use the cast of Hamilton for Ghostbusters, honestly.
I would watch the hell out of that.
Right? I mean, that's kind of, I would say, all right, sure, sure.
Someone, like, start a tweet campaign to Lin-Manuel Miranda, right?
I would, oh my God, I would watch Lin-Manuel Miranda be a Ghostbuster all day long.
I would watch Lin-Manuel Miranda do anything. He's brilliant.
All right, guys, oh, yeah. I'm gonna hashtag this, all right?
Okay, go for it. We need something catchy.
So it's Hamilton Ghostbuster, or something like that. We'll work on it. We'll tweak it. We'll workshop this. Yeah, but look in the show notes.
It. Yeah, we'll look at the show.
Maybe notes. it might even be the title of the podcast. I'm just gonna throw that out there. But at some point, look for the details. See that hashtag. Use that hashtag and get Lin-Manuel's reaction. I want to see what he thinks. But let's move on to Corrine. In addition to creating this hashtag and getting Lin-Manuel Miranda to be a Ghostbuster, what makes Ghostbusters universally relatable?
Well, Corrine, I'm going to kind of steal your point a little bit. I think the most relatable part of Ghostbusters is Ernie Hudson's character, Winston Sedmore.
Yes.
I mean, he's your everyman, average Joe character, and he helps just ground the team. And he shows that you don't have to be something special to fight against evil. Like you said, he's not a scientist. He's just a guy who needs a job. So he's just a guy with the right tools in the right place. Well, maybe the wrong time, but the right place for the New York City. And he's just like he says in the movie after they took care of Gozer, he's like, well, we had the tools and we had the talent. And that's what it boils down to for Winston. The tools and the talent of the entire team together. I mean, originally the role was written for Eddie Murphy back when Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis were writing it. And I'm not sure if he didn't want to do it or wasn't available. He had something else going on. So they scaled it back for Hudson. I mean, you know, Hudson's not a comedian, so I think that really pretty much made the decision to make his character the straight guy to the others. And as much as I love Eddie Murphy, I think Ernie Hudson's Winston was the best call to go with. I mean, with all the comedians on there, and like, not just, you know, the other three Ghostbusters, you have Rick Moranis, and you had some other good comedic roles in there and some comedic actors.
Yeah, I mean, you have...
I think... I've heard some people say that he was just supposed to be the blank slate, you know, audience fill-in kind of character. Like, this is the one, like, we're supposed to feel like we're a part of this team. But right. I don't agree with that. I think he just had his own specific role, and that was just grounding the team.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, he has character to him. I mean, he is kind of the only person who seems to not be a shyster or a kook. Yeah. I mean, that itself, I mean, I think the straight man, as they call it in comedy often, or, you know, I've heard it called the white face, because you have the white face and the red nose. Mm-hmm. You have that straight man character is so underappreciated and seen as an audience blank slate fill in kind of character. But really, it's to heighten the absurdity of the zanier characters.
Yeah, I mean,
because you have a baseline.
Yeah, exactly. If everybody's crazy and funny and stuff like that, then nobody's crazy and funny. You got to have someone. Exactly. You know, it's like everyone was rich, nobody's rich.
Exactly.
You begin to think that this is a world where everyone's just nuts. That's how it works.
Yeah. Just got the witty one-liners on the tip of their tongue.
Right. Yeah. But like, oh, okay. So it's a normal world. Gotcha. You know, that's what Ernie Hudson's character does. But also, I mean, he's a good actor. He does a good job, and it's a warm, respectable character. I think Eddie Murphy honestly would have been a similar thing, even though Eddie Murphy, we think of being as loud and Nutty Professor and all that kind of stuff. You know, think of him in Beverly Hills Cop. He is a very, even though he's cracking jokes a lot, he is a relatable, down to earth kind of like guy. Same thing with Trading Places. So he's played that kind of role. He could have taken on a similar role. That would have been interesting. But I think Ernie Hudson did great.
Yeah, but the script was different.
Oh, it had to be. Yeah, because, I mean, why wouldn't you take advantage of...
I think if Eddie Murphy was in a role, like, with the script that, as it is, was written, yeah, he would be brilliant, and he would be just as good of an actor in it. But I think the last thing the movie needed was more funny men.
Right, because
it just would depend on how it was actually written.
Yeah, it's too many chefs in the kitchen kind of problem, you know? It's just... It didn't need more crazy people, but I love Eddie Murphy. I bet you Eddie Murphy didn't want to do it because Eddie Murphy seems like the kind of guy who would prefer to be the main star in the movie and have a few steps below him on the second one, you know? So like an ensemble cast, he doesn't seem to love ensemble casts, which makes sense from a brand, personal branding standpoint.
Yeah. Know,
well, I just looked this up just so we know here. Eddie Murphy turned down Ghostbusters because he was filming Beverly Hills Cop.
Ah.
Well, I mean, but then I will say,
that
also contributes to my argument, though, is that like he was like, you know, actually, I have this other movie where I'll be the lead. I'd rather do that than do this thing where I'm going to be just one of four guys.
Well, I'm sure he probably looked at that premise and went, are you crazy? I'm not doing a movie. I'm not doing a movie about guys catching ghosts. Stupid. I'm going to go like play a wisecracking cop. Like that'll sell.
Yeah. Apparently, you know, smart choice. When it was introduced to him or he was approached about it, because, you know, Dan Aykroyd started out writing the script by himself. And I think it was Columbia was like, hey, why don't you talk to Harold Ramis over here? Kind of tone it down a little bit, because they were worried about the budget, I think it was. But originally, the movie was written for Aykroyd, John Belushi, and Eddie Murphy. So it was an entirely different monster at that point.
Well, and Dan Aykroyd, everyone's got their own opinions, but to me, Dan Aykroyd goes on that spectrum of crazy, but also a genius, but also crazy, but also a genius, but crazy.
We're gonna put a pin in the crazy, man. It's like
well, because like he does actually believe in a lot of the stuff that's in Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stuff that his characters, like he thinks, like he has a lot of opinions about certain things that would be considered conspiratorial or, you know, fringe.
We'll go with fringe.
So I would say that yes, of him writing his own, whew, that would have not been as relatable. Yeah, I think it's smart to bring on Harold Ramis. So, Kareem, let's move on to our final topic, or our penultimate topic. I know this might be a tough one, as it usually is with these, because we are really focusing on, you know, the good works of arts that we have plenty to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What could Ghostbusters have done better, Kareem?
Well, like you said, it was a little bit tough to think about it because this movie is, you know, such a large part of our upbringing. I mean, think about it. You know, yeah. When we were growing up as kids, there were Ghostbusters everywhere, lunchboxes, merchandise, movies, cartoons. I mean, you couldn't turn around without seeing Slimer somewhere.
For a good decade.
Yeah. I mean, it's a merchandise dream. But
yeah,
it was a huge lap.
Yeah. Overlap.
Yeah. It's definitely a nostalgia, you know, trip here. Just talking about it, you know, brings back seeing it like for the first time. But honestly, I think, weirdly enough, what Ghostbusters could have done better was, I think it could have used more ghosts. I mean,
Ghosts.
Well, you think about it, it's a film about busting ghosts, and there really isn't a whole lot of ghosts.
Right.
I mean, the reason I say specifically that it needs more ghosts is, it's simple. Think about it, before they open their practice, like, they lost a job, they've come across, like, one ghost, what, the one in the library? But there's not like a whole lot of ghosts like for them to go on this logical leap to, oh, we need to start an extermination practice.
It's a crackpot theory. Yeah.
But then all of a sudden they're ghost exterminators. They've got their ads out there. They've got their business. They got their leaf blowers on their back ready to suck up some ghosts. And suddenly New York City is just like crawling with ghosts. Mm-hmm. Like it's a little too serendipitous. I mean, usually before you start a business, there should be some sort of consumer need. And, you know, it's all of a sudden they start the business and boom, there's a market. I mean, and there might have been consumer need that we just didn't see because it's not shown in the movie. And I think that's what we need to see. Like, what made them go specifically think this is a viable way to make a living? Yeah. And that's...
I mean, that you're right, because it does. It's one of those double-edged sword things where it cuts into the believability of it, which cuts into the relatability and the grounding of a comedy, which is important. But then at the same time, like, it is a funny concept that they're so stupid to think this will work. It's kind of a double-edged sword, yeah. But you're right. They could have at least shown... What they could have done is they could have done something where it's not even with any characters that are later in the film, but just instances of ghosts that we see lurking in the shadows and being there waiting to be exposed or something like that. Yeah, no, I definitely agree.
And it could have been like to keep the need for the practical effects down, because if I remember correctly, they use mostly practical effects for these ghosts. Sure. Obviously not all of them, but... it could have been a need to keep the budget down, which is why they went with the less ghosts. But, I mean, can we just get, like, a scene where someone's, like, buying coffee and you see a ghost poke up through, you know, the pastries? That's all I'm saying.
I think the less ghostliness, the better. Because, I mean, have either of you seen the new one, the 2016?
No.
Which one are we talking about? The one with
the all female reboot,
the Tina Fey and everything. Yes, I have. Yeah.
Okay, so they go the opposite way. They show ghosts and ghosts and ghosts and ghosts, and they're everywhere. And the the special effects budget is so ballooned, and like honestly it loses its effect. But I can honestly say that I've never thought about what you brought up just now. Like the thought of, is there an actual need for this business has never crossed my mind until you said something. And now I'm thinking about it. And I'm like,
I had to dig really hard to think. I didn't want to keep being a cop out. I know our last two episodes, I couldn't come up with a point. So I just had to really think hard about it. But on the note, there's got to be a happy medium, no pun intended there, but too many ghosts and not enough. So, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen the reboot, the 2016 remake, because everyone said it was garbage. And so I don't want to watch movies that people think are garbage.
You know,
it hasn't been on a streaming service where it's free.
It's problem, and I'll just give my short opinion. I don't want to let this devolve into a critique of another movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we never do that.
Right. But I will say, Dalton touched on something with it having too many ghosts. To me, my problem with it is that in any comedy, you have to have a runway. Mm-hmm. And you need to pick up speed and then take off, because the whole secret sauce to comedy is escalation.
Yes.
So you have something and then it escalates and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and it's out of hand now. And now it's all the plates are spinning and it's kooky. But if it starts that way, and that's kind of part of the problem to me, is that it starts that, that Ghostbusters in terms of the ghost, sure. But then also just the zaniness, the jokes a mile a minute, just the we basically are just constantly thrown into things to grab our attention. And so there's no ramping up in the movie at all. It starts at 100.
It's like, hey, remember Slimer? You remember Slimer, don't you?
They show him early.
Here's a whole house full of it. Remember that? You remember ectoplasm?
Okay. Yeah, it's I mean, I understand it's sort of a sequel, so maybe you can get away with that, but it's really a reboot.
A reboot.
And they tried to kind of toe the line between what it was, but it's definitely, I think they missed out on what made Ghostbusters so good. And so part of it was its groundedness.
Yeah.
And its relatability. And I think you lose some of that when you start with the, going a mile a minute.
Yeah. And it's also hard to be a reboot when they put the original characters in the movie. especially when one of them shows up as an actual, related to one of the main characters.
Ernie, yeah.
Yeah. When Ernie shows up, I don't even remember if he does show up, actual shows up. But he is mentioned as her uncle who owned the car or whatever. And I'm just it's too close. It's too close. And then they've got a bust of Egon in the background. And that's his cameo. And I'm just really? Mm-hmm. We didn't need it. And when you put things that close together, when one universe is supposed to be apart from another, but then you interject the same characters, it blurs the line, and I didn't like it.
Well, so we all agree that one's not good. So don't watch that one.
Yeah, don't
re-watch. Watch this one for the first time or rewatch it. But let's go ahead and dissect it a little more. Dalton, what do you think this Ghostbusters, the original, could have done better?
Okay, for me, the weakest part of the film, aside from the go job scene, you guys know the one I'm talking about?
The what?
I refer to it as the go job scene.
Oh, yes. God, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, because, like,
yeah.
It's so yeah, out of place. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
I'm not even going to go into it. Like, that alone, I was sitting there thinking, like, when you were talking about Dan Aykroyd writing the script, I was like, that's definitely something that he put in there that made it into the final cut, because I can just see him going, oh, my God, this is something I've always wanted. Oh, and then just. But anyway, for me, the weakest part of this was the setup and payoff of what I like to refer to as the BEM trademark, the boss ending mechanic. I'm a game designer, so like I'm always looking for systems and mechanics and the way things work and patterns mm-hmm. and whatnot. But mm-hmm. So this is the boss ending mechanic. It's the thing that the characters use finally that they didn't have before to defeat the final boss. In some fantasy, this could be like a mythical weapon. Or like an item that needs to be destroyed in order to weaken the boss, you know, the big bad evil guy. Right. Or it could be like the power of love. You know, sometimes I mean that's overdone, but you right. see what I'm saying. It's the thing that eventually ends up leading to the main villain's demise. And I was so used to Egon and the others coming up with something off the wall that when he suggested crossing the streams, which is in defiance of a single throwaway line near the middle of the film, mm-hmm. as a way to defeat the evil overlord, it almost felt like a cop-out. I really wanted them to find something brainier. I mean, that's it. That's all I got. I wanted them to find another way. The rest of the movie was so cleverly written mm-hmm. that to me it was like, oh, okay, well let's do that thing that it was funny in the middle of the movie, so let's do that thing he said not to do, and then that'll be the end.
I think that's a really great point. I mean, it is a weak ending if you think about it. Especially like the boss ending mechanic. You see that so much in lots of different media, whether it's video games, you know, books, things like that, where it's just something like this big bad boss, but oh, they have a weak point, or they have this one specific thing that's just going to take them out. So I really think that's a great point you brought up.
Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, my problem is that I do just really like that ending. I do like the do, re, mi. I like all the, like, I like them doing it. I feel like it's a way for them to defeat the boss together. I feel like it makes the comedy the thing that wins. So I like a lot of the aspects of it, but I do understand how it is definitely a cop-out. I mean, it's not something where it's like, oh, yeah, this is just clever, and I wouldn't have thought of that, and, you know, how in the moment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you got a point.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I don't know, what Ghostbusters could have done better? I don't really think it could have done much, because, honestly, this is near a perfect movie for me.
It's true. I had to stretch. I had to stretch.
I understand. The thing I could really think of is I wasn't exactly enthralled by the romantic subplot, you know, between Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver.
That was like my number two. If you hadn't taken that one, I was going to go with that one.
Right. And I mean, I think it was cute, but, you know, I didn't. And they had some great chemistry, mm-hmm. but I didn't have a burning need to see them together. Like, I didn't feel like they completed one another, you know. I didn't feel, which, you know, I didn't need per se, which again, it's to me, it didn't ruin the movie or hurt it really at all. But it's something where it's like, well, if you were going to try to improve the story, if you had to have the impossible task of punching up the script, mm-hmm. what would you work on?
Exactly.
I would probably work on the romance, just because it's like, well, you know, I can just build in something where it's like the audience really wants to see these two together.
Yeah.
And working off the fairy tale aspect, if they had done just a little bit more building of the relationship and made it a little less, to me, it was almost creepy a little bit. Just some of the dialogue and some of the suggestions.
He comes across as such a womanizer.
Yeah.
That you're just like, I don't really take him as, you know, authentically wanting something.
Yeah.
Right.
If they played that up just a little bit more, not the sleazy part, but the romance, like, and his reaction to, like his love interest being turned into a hideous demon creature, like, mm-hmm. that would also have played into the fairy tale role, mm-hmm. because, okay. you know, true love's kiss or something like that. Like, wouldn't that have been funny now that I'm thinking about that? Like, it's just like, why does she not turn back to normal? And then Egon's like, I don't know. And then, Eddie's like, well, I don't know. Maybe you got to kiss her. He's like, what? And they're all like, what? He's like, I don't know. Like, you know, like Frog Prince and all that. Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, sure, it could have been a moment.
Yeah,
anyway.
I like it. There we go. But I think we're on the same page.
They're doing another Ghostbusters, so like, I don't remember who's doing it, but let's tweet that to them.
We got
too.
Time. Yeah, we got time to work that in. Lin-Manuel can kiss whoever he deems worthy of kissing. Hamilton may kiss who he pleases, but
I'm sure he'll be happy to have your permission.
Right, man, woman, ghost. But yes, let's wrap up the thoughts that we have with our final thoughts about Ghostbusters. So I'll go ahead and just start. I just want to say, you know, it's one of my favorite comedies of all time. Most of its humor comes from the people in it being funny, even delivering unfunny lines. And by that, I don't mean bad jokes. I mean just lines that are just normal lines. They can make you laugh. I mean, they just make you smile. And that's really the actors. Even the characters are they're funny in-world, which I love.
Yeah,
It's okay for the other people laugh at their jokes. And you're like, oh, he made a joke, not he is a joke. Mm-hmm. Or he's saying something and I'm laughing, but no one else is taking them seriously. Other people take the joke. It's a joke.
Yeah.
And it makes them relatable to me, for one thing. But I feel like today jokes are meant for the audience in almost a dramatic irony sense.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like, you know, the audience will understand that this is a joke, but, you know, the characters on screen will be stuck in their narrative, you know?
Yeah.
It's that meta humor that I hate it. And it's so pervasive now that I almost can't stand to watch like Marvel movies because of it sometimes.
Yeah, there is a touch of that in some of the Marvel stuff. Really, it's just, I feel like it's one of also, I mean, it is an 80s movie, but it comes out of the 70s. Because that 70s style of comedy that the stars of Ghostbusters so embody is really about just not pretending, you know. It's really about like just, hey, you know, a lot of it's like kind of almost a quasi hippie aesthetic where it's like, hey, don't be a square, man, you know, like just what do you do, like why are you acting like the man, like why are you just act normal, dude. So it's just a special movie to me. It's a real near and dear one to me. Kareen, what final thoughts do you have about Ghostbusters?
Well, as of the time of this recording, Ghostbusters is 36 years old. It's still a great movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, like I said earlier, it has that almost timeless feel to it. And obviously not the very 80s look of it or the feel or that hair, but the script and dialogue itself. And it's still a great watch. And it's personally not on my, oh my God, I watch this so much list. It's not Star Wars. I will stop and watch it when it's on TV. Now, when it celebrated the 30th anniversary 6 years ago, it appeared in select cinemas on the big screen. I definitely grabbed tickets and went with my friends, and we had a good old time because, well, that was the first time I ever saw it on the big screen because I was one when it came out. Between the cast and the script, and it just has endless rewatchability, and it's just a really great movie. It's one of those ones that you're going to sit down, you're going to watch it, you're going to quote it, or you're not going to quote it because you haven't watched it that much, but you're just going to enjoy it. And I think that's what makes it great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well put.
It's a definite popcorn movie, and there's a distinct lack of those nowadays. Movies where you go to watch the movie. You don't go because it's highfalutin or like a spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't go to talk about it afterwards.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
So the whole idea is just to go and watch it, and then you'll talk about it because you'll be hyped. But like, it's not like, what did you think of that scene?
Yeah.
But Dalton, what are your final thoughts about Ghostbusters? Wrap us up.
Well, I think overall that the 80s was a special time for movies and moviegoers. I dare say it was probably the true golden era of cultural cinema. I mean, we had Empire Strikes Back, Gremlins, Ghostbusters, The Lost Boys, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, The Terminator, Die Hard, Top Gun, Breakfast Club, Back to the Future, Harry Met Sally. The list goes on. Mm-hmm. Every one of those films has become a cultural landmark, like part of our cultural identity. And Ghostbusters is part of that pantheon of 80s film gods. And to this day, it has not been matched in terms of novelty and pure chemistry, I would say.
Excellent. Yeah. Well put, Dalton. And that's a good summation to it in general. So let's leave it there.
All right.
Let's see, guys, though. Well, all right. Well, bye, guys.
Bye.
But no, let's talk about where we can find you guys. Because, you know, after listening to this, you might want to find these folks on social media and such. Corrine, why don't you let everybody know where they can follow you at?
Okay, if you want to stalk me on social media, my Facebook and my Instagram are both Nonlinear Girl, and my Twitter is Nonlinear Girl with a 0 instead of an O.
Okay, very good. Dalton, where can people follow you?
You can find me on Instagram on sword_gaijin. And on Facebook at The Sword Gaijin Cosplay.
Excellent. And for me, you know, I'm going to be mainly haunting the Fiction File Facebook. So if you guys want to drop by there, I'll be there. And you can always find me on Twitter at The Fiction File. There's also Fiction File Mag, which is the Fiction File personal or publication Twitter, rather, I should say. The Fiction File is just my personal Twitter if you want to follow me. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for another great podcast. I really do appreciate all the insightful comments. Corrine, if I want to watch Ghostbusters for the 200th time, where can I find the streaming?
Well, Ghostbusters is unfortunately not included as part of a subscription service, but you can rent or buy it from your favorite digital store like YouTube, Google Play, or iTunes. Or you can head on over to fictionfile.com and click on the Amazon banner on top of our page, and you can buy it on Blu-ray or DVD. It won't cost you any extra. It just gives us a little referral, which helps us continue to bring you the content you've grown to love. And as a side note, in October, you can generally almost always find Ghostbusters on Freeform.
There you go. Awesome. Not sure what Freeform is, but I'm sure you guys can Google it.
They're the ones with the rights to TV rights.
Oh, I see.
Very good, very good. Well, all right, everybody. Thanks, Kareen. Thanks, Dalton. That's it for this installment of the Fiction File podcast. I want to thank you, the listener at home, and I want to invite you to visit fictionfile.com for more scintillating analysis like you heard today. And don't forget to rate us if you like today's episode, and subscribe to make sure you don't miss the next episode. Until then, I want to thank you for spending a little story time with us today. And for Dalton McKay and Kareen Asbell, this is Jason Boyd and the Fiction File family wishing you a happily ever after.